Oral argument in State versus Randall Doyle, docket number 47832. We are conducting this hearing via Zoom. Appearing on behalf of the appellant is Douglas Phelps, and on behalf of the respondent is Casey Jones. Mr. Phelps, you may present your opening argument.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. This is a situation, the facts are, as Judge Wayman indicated, pretty clear. My client had been in a struggle with an assailant, had retreated into the camper that he was living in, and there have been prior struggles between them, and the assailant that was attempting to enter his camper was armed with a firearm, and as he attempted to enter, my client shot the assailant one time. And the issue, those charges of aggravated battery were dismissed, but the state proceeded to prosecute for the unlawful possession of a firearm. It's our position that the statute is very clear in RCW 19-202A that there should be no prosecution of any kind for anyone who's involved in defending themselves under situations such as my client was under when he was forced to shoot the individual who was breaking into his abode. What overshadows this argument is our position is Article 1, Section 1 of the Idaho State Constitution, the section regarding inalienable rights of men. It says that all men are by nature free and equal and have certain inalienable rights, among which are enjoying and defending life, liberty, acquiring and possessing and protecting property, and pursuing happiness and security and safety. And the statute that was enacted by the legislature advances that freedom, and we believe clarifies that freedom. To the point where in the statute it says that in the statute 19-202A, it says in any prosecution for the unlawful use of force, including deadly force or attempt or threatened use of force, contrary to Title 18, which is the title that my client was charged with, but for unlawful possession of firearms. The statute does not require interpretation because the legislature was very clear in the language that they used in 19-202A that there should not be any prosecution whatsoever for anybody that was engaged in an action defending themselves under certain circumstances, including entry into a vehicle, an abode, or to a business. And the citizens of Idaho should be able to rely upon that, as should my client have been able to rely upon that in his use of force, even though he was charged under Title 18 with unlawful possession. The court chose to apply some ambiguity, which we do not see, and interpret the statute to only apply to the aggravated battery charge and not to the Title 18 unlawful possession of a firearm. We believe that if the court interprets not only the statute as clearly written by the legislature, but considers the Idaho State Constitution, that the court should not have convicted Mr. Doyle of unlawful possession of a firearm. And I think that succinctly states the nature of our arguments. We also argued that there was a necessity defense in this case, which the court also interpreted in its decision that some states do allow unlawful possession of a firearm in self-defense cases. Seems to be a split of authority, but chose to, in this case, follow the authority that did not allow possession of a firearm under necessity, the necessity defense. So I'll reserve the balance of my time for a response unless there's questions.
There appear to be no questions at this time, Mr. Phelps. Thank you. Ms. Jones, argument on behalf of the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. The district court did not err when it found Doyle guilty of unlawful possession of a firearm in this case. And there are two initial points I want to hit before addressing the merits of Doyle's arguments here. The first is that this crime was completed prior to Shell and Doyle's interaction at the trailer. He was charged with unlawfully possessing a firearm, and that happened when he took possession of the gun the day prior. He continued to be in unlawful possession of the firearm when he brought the gun into his trailer. He was in unlawful possession of the firearm as he slept, as he was going about his business, knowing he was possessing that firearm in his control in his trailer. And so because that unlawful possession of a firearm occurred prior to the self-defense, all of Doyle's self-defense related claims simply don't address the remainder of that possession. And he hasn't provided any defense to what is an undisputed unlawful possession in all of those hours preceding his altercation with Shell. Another point I would like to...
Ms. Jones, do we need to go beyond that in this case? Meaning beyond a conclusion that the crime for which he was convicted, unlawful possession, was complete before any claim of self-defense or necessity, or regardless of any constitutional argument?
No, Your Honor, I don't think this court does. He was charged with unlawfully possessing the firearm on November 9th, and there's undisputed evidence that he possessed that on November 9th before any threats, at least up to 1 p.m. And so on that basis alone, this court could conclude that the evidence was sufficient. And because there was no raised defenses about that time of possession, this court doesn't need to address any of the remaining issues that have been raised on appeal. And the second point I'd like to make on just initially before addressing the merits is that self-defense was considered. Doyle has argued on appeal that either the statute or the Constitution provides him a self-defense right to possess a gun, but the district court considered self-defense specifically. And so it went through that analysis. It determined self-defense did not apply in this case because that possession existed well before any altercation arose. And Doyle hasn't challenged the self-defense analysis at all. And so on that basis as well, this court could conclude that the conviction was proper and it doesn't need to address the remaining elements. But getting just briefly to the arguments that have been raised on appeal, the statute here does not apply to this charge. Idaho Code 19-202A very specifically applies to legal protections for the use of force, the attempted use of force, or the threatened use of force in response to an imminent danger. That is not implicated here. He was not charged or tried with the use of force. He was tried for possessing a firearm. Nothing in that statute is so broadly worded as to allow just a general right for anyone at any time to prepare themselves in any situation. And so that's not implicated here. As I've cited in my brief, there are cases that have addressed this in response to defense of others' claim and specifically found that you can't use this statute to protect criminal actions taken after a crime has been committed against someone. It has to be in response to an imminent threat or an ongoing offense. And that same logic would dictate that you can't use this to apply before any such threat is made. This statute.
Sorry, Ms. Jones, would you agree, as the prosecutor seemed to suggest, that you have to possess the firearm in order to use it?
Yes, I would agree that in order to use it, you do have to possess it. Possession carries with it the idea of control. But I think that this statute is aimed at looking at the actual use of force. This would be a very different case if Doyle had been visiting his grandfather and Shell had attacked him there, and his grandfather has the gun shop, and if he randomly grabbed a gun to protect himself, that would present a really interesting case and one where I think this court would have to grapple with the possession, the use, the actions taken in response. That's not this case, though. In this case, he possessed the gun far in advance of that, before any threat. And so the unlawful act that he committed, the action arguably taken here, was possessing a gun, and it was not in response to any sort of immediate threat. And so Section 19202A simply doesn't apply here. But again, even if it did, all Section 19202A does is recognize that self-defense is a viable defense to these claims. And in certain circumstances, there's a presumption of reasonable action and the state has the burden. Self-defense was considered here. The district court placed the burden on the state here, and Doyle has not challenged how that was applied. So even if Section 19202A were to apply, and even if we were looking only at the time he's urging us to look at on appeal, it still fails. Turning to the constitutional provision, very briefly, the Idaho constitutional provision granting the right to bear arms specifically recognizes that the legislation has the ability to penalize the possession of firearms by felons. He has cited absolutely no case law for either the Second Amendment or the Idaho Constitution that would indicate there's any issue with prohibiting felons from possessing firearms. And he cited absolutely nothing that would indicate that there's this general right for felons to possess firearms in their homes, in their vehicles, in their businesses, on their persons for self-defense. And as the district court noted, interpreting either the statute or the constitutions to have such a meaning would essentially write out Idaho Code 18-3316. It would no longer have any meaning to say that the legislation could penalize the possession of firearms by felons if they were allowed to possess it. In any event, they might have some generalized fear of something at some time, which is essentially all that happened here. And turning last to his necessity defense, he argued necessity again as related to the specific time he used the firearm, but the unlawful possession charge is related to the entire possession, not just the time during which the gun was used. The district court considered that, it went through each element in detail, and the district court's decisions were correct. Doyle did not possess this gun. The unlawful possession was not in response to a specific immediate threat of harm. He testified somewhat inconsistently that he got the gun at the preliminary hearing. He testified he got it because of prowlers in the area. At trial, he testified he got it because he was menaced by a gang that he thought might want to do him harm. There was reference to a vague threat from Shell in the preceding time. None of that is a specific threat of immediate harm. And he also had less offensive actions he could have taken. He had time to go to his grandfather's property to get a gun. He could have called law enforcement. He had time to take a nap. He could have called law enforcement. He could have gone to his grandfather or mother's property. He could have used the phone. He could have left the residence. Any of those were available options to him that he did not take. And so for the reasons discussed by the district court and as spelled out more thoroughly in my brief, the state would ask this court to affirm, because there's no dispute on the record here that Doyle unlawfully possessed a firearm for 24 hours before any threat arose. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Mr. Phelps, rebuttal?
I strongly disagree. In this case, the facts are that Mr. Doyle was believing that he was under threat, that he might have bodily harm occur to him. There had been threats, there had been statements made that someone was going to kill him. There was discussion that they would take him, that perhaps he would be taken out in a hunting accident and killed, involving the perpetrator in this particular case. Mr. Doyle did take possession of a firearm. And if we read 19-202A sub 2, it says the defense of self or another does not require a person to wait until he or she ascertains whether the danger is apparent or real. A person confronted with such danger has a right to act upon appearances such as would influence the action of a reasonable person. Now in subsection 4, it says, it talks about the unlawful use of force, including deadly force, or the attempted or threatened use of force to Title 18 of the Idaho Code, which is what my client was charged under. It's significant to remember that these two gentlemen, that the other gentleman had a gun outside the trailer, was shooting off the gun, that they became involved in a physical altercation where the assailant attempted to gouge out his eyes, that my client, Mr. Doyle, retreated into his trailer. He did not bring the gun out at any time prior to that, but he did tell the assailant not to enter the trailer. And he's in his trailer, armed with a firearm. The gentleman breaches the door and starts to come into the trailer, armed with a firearm, and Mr. Doyle shoots one time, and the gentleman was shot and retreated from the trailer. It's a classic situation under the statute. Now, he perceived a threat prior to that and took possession of the firearm, but never used it, never displayed it, never did anything until the perpetrator attempted to enter the home or the residence or the abode. And at that point, he used the firearm. The government attempts to get around that by claiming that he just could not possess it in anticipation that he might need it to protect himself. And contrary to clear language, it says that whenever the parent, he doesn't have to ascertain whether the danger is apparent or real. When confronted with a danger, he has the right to act upon the appearances. He took possession of it, did not use it until the gentleman started to come into the trailer with a gun in hand, and that only then did he fire the weapon.
Mr. Phelps?
Yes.
Doesn't your argument essentially elevate a statutory right to self-defense above the Constitution, specifically the Second Amendment, as it has been interpreted by the Supreme Court of the United States?
Well, I think my argument is based more on the Idaho State Constitution, Article 1, Section 1. But in this
which
case,
specifically allows for regulation of firearms by statute. Are you abandoning your Second Amendment argument?
Well, I think there's both a Second Amendment argument, but the court needs to interpret these two statutes to accomplish the purpose that was set out in the legislature. The legislature is presumed to know that there is unlawful possession of firearms charge up there. And when they enacted this 19-202A, they were aware of the statute. And I believe that in the language in the statute, they took care of that issue.
But the United States Supreme Court, as to your Second Amendment claim, if you are not abandoning that, the United States Supreme Court has said that the possession of firearms can be regulated. So isn't your argument that basically that the statutory right in Idaho to self-defense supersedes the interpretation of the Second Amendment?
I believe that the Second Amendment in a situation involving the use of a firearm that's occurring within the forum and within the home, such as occurred here, would uphold the lawful possession of the firearm. But beyond that, in Idaho, we're under an additional constitutional provision that appears to grant, and the state law statute supports the grant of a right to possess a firearm, even if you're a convicted felon, when you're defending yourself within your home. Or you've taken possession of that firearm, anticipating that you're going to need it to protect yourself in your home, which is what Mr. Doyle did. He didn't bring it out, didn't use it. He kept it in the trailer. And only when the man began to breach the trailer did he shoot him with that firearm. And he warned him before he did it. This is a classic. And the statute says that an attempt or threat to use force contrary to Title 18, and he was charged under Title 18. The legislature included an exemption for this in the statute. which the court attempts to find a way to work around, and the legislature did not intend. They properly granted Mr. Doyle with the right to protect himself in a very dangerous situation, which did not result in the death of Mr. Doyle or the death of the individual that was breaking into the trailer. This law worked perfectly, except for Mr. Doyle was convicted of a felony, which the legislature did not intend for him to be convicted of under these circumstances.
Mr. Phelps?
Yes.
Good morning. I have a question in that regard. So what is your response to the argument that if we interpret 19202A to allow a felon to possess a firearm in self-defense in this circumstance, that doesn't supersede or abrogate section 18-3316, which is the statute prohibiting a felon from possessing a firearm?
Well, the legislature talks about Title 18, which is what the statute, Title 18 is what he was charged under. It's our contention that the legislature intended to grant the authority to someone, even a felon, within their own home, business, or vehicle, where they're in imminent fear, or they, as the statute reads in Section 2, the defense of self does not require a person to wait until he or she ascertains whether the danger is apparent or real. A person confronted with danger has a clear right to act upon appearances such as would influence the action of a reasonable person. We need to remember, too, that we're out in the very rural part of North Idaho. Counsel argues, well, there's a phone available, could have called the police. Well, you might call the police, but they might not be able to respond in a timely enough manner when you're facing an imminent threat. So that danger is very real, and as it was with Mr. Doyle in a rural part of North Idaho. We're not asking the court to say, yeah, as a felon, you can just possess a gun, go out through your neighborhood and walk. But we are asking the court to uphold the statute and grant even a felon who's under attack in his home, business, or car to, if there's a weapon available, grab that weapon, use it to defend himself, and not be in fear that he's going to be charged criminally for that act of defense. The legislature is clear on what they were granting. The court's attempting to interpret around the legislature. And if this court rules according to what the legislature intended, then it's up to the legislature to change the law and clarify it that they're not allowing felons in these situations to use a firearm to defend themselves or even possess it in that situation. And they can do that. They can change the law and clarify it. But this court should interpret the statute as written, give an effect to it, and not allow Mr. Doyle to have been convicted of an unlawful possession of a firearm, given the facts of this case. He testified that he believed that they were going to try and either the man that was the assailant or others were going to try and kill him. And he had a real fear for that. He had the firearm in his abode, never used it, never took it, you know, out with him, but he merely maintained it in the abode and then ultimately had to use it to save his life. And it worked as the legislature intended. I'm sorry.
Mr. Phelps?
Yes.
The imminent threat when he acquired the firearm was what?
Well, he said that he was under the understanding, he had been heard the rumors, he had had what he believed was credible evidence that that someone was going to attempt to kill him. And law enforcement, I would submit that even if law enforcement were called, they wouldn't be able to immediately protect him, or would they take any action? All he did was obtain the firearm, secret it within his home, and have it there available to him for the purpose that he ultimately used it on. And had he been out in the community and he was attacked by the people in the community, we would have an entirely different factual situation. He obtained the firearm from his grandfather, took it and kept it in the trailer, did not go out in the community and threaten anyone or use it in any other fashion. He merely had it available to him there to use in the situation of
imminent. So is your position, Mr. Phelps, that if he was walking around in the community with the firearm, that he could be convicted of unlawful possession?
Well, my position would be that the law says that they cannot be convicted when defense of self or another, when it was believed that he was under apparent or real threat, he had a right to maintain and keep that firearm in his home, and then ultimately had a right to use it. And these, we're talking about a matter of days from when he possessed it within the home, and he ultimately had to use it. So he had he believed that there was a danger. There was a danger, and it came to fruition that he had to use that firearm. He didn't take it out when the man was beating him out in the outside of the trailer. Only when he attempted to enter the trailer.
Mr. Phelps, as to my specific question,
yes,
is it your position that he could or could not possess the firearm in the community?
If he had it under the situation where he was taking it to his trailer to use to deal with an imminent threat, I believe he could possess it under the statute, because he's only taking it to his abode, and I think under this law, business or automobile, in anticipation that he's going to have to use it for self-defense, which he did. I understand the reluctance to have a felon be in possession of the firearm, but I also understand the legislature wanting people, particularly in rural communities, to have the ability to defend themselves when law enforcement is not readily available. We're not talking about Boise. We're not talking about a downtown area of Boise. We're talking about rural Benoit County. Sometimes cell phones don't work. If they do work, the response of law enforcement might be very delayed. And so sometimes, given that situation, as occurred here, one should be able to possess a firearm when there is a need to protect themselves in their home. Otherwise, you're leaving a significant portion of the population at risk, which I don't believe the legislature wanted to have happen. And Article 1, Section 1 supports that, and as does the statute. Very, very interesting situation. If there's any other questions?
Here to be none, Mr. Phelps. Thank you. The court appreciates the briefing and argument of counsel in this case. The case is submitted and a written decision will issue in due course. The court will be in recess until the 10:30 oral arguments.
Thank you.